was killed in Gaza yesterday. His wife was my student, and it's tremendously sad. And there's a lot going on here. And because of that, precisely, I think because of that, it's important for us to maintain not only our physical fortitude, but our moral fortitude in the midst of a very, very difficult war, which looks like it's going to go on for a while. And that's before you get to Hezbollah and other areas as well. And precisely because of the anticipated length of this war, and whether it's this war or the next war or the next conflict, wherever it might be, maintaining an amount of moral fortitude is very critical, particularly in light of the fact of what's going on in the world and the critiques of Israel and genocide claims, the Hague, and all sorts of other types of claims, which, I think on the face of it, many times are just readily dismissible. But there is a larger question, which we're going to be focusing on in this series, which is the issue of the biblical legacy or the Jewish legacy when it comes to civilian casualties. Because in general, when it comes to the issues of ethics of war, there's sort of two different ways we think about them. It's a much broader question about why this is, but there's two different ways we think of. One is why one goes to war, or how can you justify going to war? And then there's a second issue, which is really separate, which is when you are in war, how do you fight that war ethically? Okay. And obviously, the issue of civilian casualties is an issue that goes into both, right? Because one question you have to ask is how do you justify going to war when it's going to cause so many civilian casualties? But beyond that, when you're in the war, there's always this dilemma of, well, how do we justify or explain the fact that some people who aren't fighting get harmed greatly, even killed by this warfare? And when it comes for Jews, this issue is a bit more acute because we have to deal with this question with the biblical legacy as well, which clearly accepts warfare with equanimity, if not in favor of it in certain circumstances, but doesn't give us too much when it comes to questions of restraints on war and the limits on warfare. And the Jewish tradition didn't develop, as it does in other areas of life, a sort of mesorah about thinking about these issues, because for many centuries we didn't have power. So this dilemma wasn't acute, so it doesn't get discussed. Like if you compare, for example, the work we do in Emathai. So as we've discussed this in other Torah Motion series. So we deal with end-of-life care. So of course, there are many differences between end-of-life care today than there was, let's say, in the 13th century. But we have discussions in the 13th century and many other centuries about how to deal with people towards the end of the life and withholding, withdrawing care, et cetera, et cetera. We just don't really have this when it comes to the issues of the ethics of war. And what I want to try to cover in these 3 weeks together is three great episodes, three great moments in my mind in which we were confronted with these questions of the 20th century. And to explore the different ways in which rabbis and other leaders try to deal with these types of ethical dilemmas. And what I try to argue, as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, I have been working on this book for quite some time. And as Rabbi Kelman guessed, I didn't start writing it on October 8th. I had someone who said to me, wow, I can't believe you got the book out that quickly. You must have just sat down. And I was like, no. That is not how this book came to be. And it is sort of surreal. I've been waiting it for several years, and it's sort of surreal on many different levels that it comes out now. The book is called Ethics of Our Fighters. And the reason why I call this, obviously a play on Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, but the idea that I'm trying to capture, of course, is that we have ethics of our fathers, right? We have these moral teachings, which say nothing about how to fight in war. And that's why we now have to create an ethics of our fighters. And what I want to try to show you starting today is how rabbis in the 20th century began to deal with this issue in an acute way. Now, we know that Jews were fighting in modern wars, in European wars, in the 18th and 19th centuries, you start to be allowed into militaries. And there are interesting questions that come up, particularly with regard to conscription and Jewish ritual law and whatnot, kashrut. But really in the 20th century is when the ethical dilemmas come to heart. A bit in World War I, for sure. There are many, many, many Jews who fight on both sides, by the way, in World War I. But it's with the great Zionist dilemmas of the 1930s, 20s, and particularly the 30s, in which the dilemmas become acute. And I want to start discussing those with you now. So here you're going to see the headline, November 10th, 1937. This is Hadavar. This is the one of the major newspapers in Mandatory Palestine. And the title declares 50,000 Jews accompany the five martyrs who were killed by terrorists or B'nai Avilah. And it discusses that different stages where these five workers, four workers and their guard, four recent Polish immigrants, along with their guard, were killed in the area of Kiryat Anavim, which is right outside of Jerusalem. You might be familiar with Kiryat Anavim is where Neve Ilan is. And we now have a hotel at a small moshav, which is next to where these five were killed, called Malach Hamisha. So Malach Hamisha is named for these five that were killed working in the fields. And you can see it's a dramatic event. Rav Herzog, chief rabbi, comes. Moshe Shertok, later known as Moshe Sharet, born minister of the Jewish Agency, comes. Yitzchak Ben Zvi, later second president of Israel, comes. Rav Bloy, the head of the Aguda, comes. Right? So this is a big event. And you can see on the right side that the Rav Rashi, Rav Herzog, gives a hesped, where he says, listen, Jews, we would never kill anyone, damnaki. But where are the leaders of Islam? Where are they right now? I understand how civilized nations aren't calling out this immoral behavior. Now, this is not the first murder that happens. Starting in 1936, the Arabs, the local Arabs, begin what's known as the Great Revolt from 36 to 39, in which they say, we're fed up with the British, we're fed up with the Jews, we want to have our own state, we want to have get rid of the mandate, and they lead a revolt against British rule where they attack British soldiers, but more than British, they attack the Jews. And so this has already been going on for over a year, and you can see that Moshe Shertok gets up, and he says, here I have the JTA bulletin right below him, where he says, we need to arm Jewish workers. The Brits need to do more to uproot terrorism. We need to, prioritize self-defense, meaning there's no pacifism here. We want to have self-defense, but we will not do reprisal attacks. That is, give a tip for attack, right? Give them their own piece of our medicine, because our reprisal will be the intensive continuation of our peaceful work. But as you can see, 5 days later, once again, Hadavar, there is a open letter from the Jewish Agency telling people it is unacceptable to go and fight terrorists with terror, to have these reprisal killings. This only hurts our cause and makes us look bad in the world. What is that a response to? That is a response to Black Sunday, 1937, known as Black Sunday. This is on November 11th. 1937. November 11th, 1930 is what we now call, in America at least, call Veterans Day. But in 1937, it was just called Armistice Day, right? In other words, it wasn't World War II yet. It was just a World War I. And November 11th is when they're commemorating Armistice Day. And on that day, Jews, later, now understood later on, by led by the Etzel, figures in the Etzel, throw bombs into a post office, kill one Arab, wound five others. They threw another one at a railway station. And over the next couple of days, Jews openly attack random Arabs as a reprisal for the terror attacks against the five martyrs. Okay? And you can see that later on, the Etzel leader, David Raziel, who'd been for a short time a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook's in the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, Rabbi, not Rabbi, but David Raziel writes an essay where he explains He who saw the faces of the Arabs on Black Sunday and the days following is able to describe for himself what fear fell on them. All of their insolent heroism that in the past year and a half pierced their eyes disappeared suddenly at once. He who does not want to be defeated has no choice but to attack. He needs to charge his enemy and to break his force and his will. And so the argument that they're making is, listen, we don't know and we don't have a way of capturing those who have harmed us, who have attacked us. But in the meantime, we can either take the approach of havlaga, which is known as restraint, that's advocated by the Haganah, of self-defense, but of not proactively taking it to the other side. Or we can take the approach of tiguva, or what he calls Haganah aktivit, right? Active defensism, right? In which you say, we're going to take it to them. And that means attacking anyone on their side because we don't know who the enemies are. So we're just going to kill any Arabs as well. What you might call fighting terror with terror. So this is the great debate that emerges in the late 30s. And what I want to try to work out with you is a bit of how the resources, the ethical resources from our tradition, how this was used amongst the rabbis, and as we're going to see, not just by rabbis, by political leaders as well, because it was of great interest to Ben-Gurion and to Charette and to others, what exactly does the Jewish tradition have to say on this issue. Now, we already saw Rav Herzog was very upset about the phenomenon of reprisals, and he and the Sephardic chief rabbi, Rav Yaakov Meir at the time, this is right before Rav Uziel becomes chief rabbi, come out with a very strong statement. Chalila, chalila, shur dam Yisrael l'mo derech v'shei goyim. God forbid that we should emulate the ways of the goyim. This is a terrible thing. We've never done this throughout the centuries. We've been attacked, but we never can't randomly killed random enemies. Zo gdulatenu, zo tifartenu, lishmor tideir mitoavot achzot keilu, afilu b'shot yoter k'shovarot. This is our greatness, that we've never gone to this measures, even in the worst hours, and God forbid that we should desecrate Jewish ethics. And indeed, what I'm now going to show you, and we'll show you now is transcripts that we have preserved. I know it's going to be hard for you to see. It's hard for me to see as well, but I wanted to just give you a feel for it. Transcripts that we have from the Jewish agency executive meetings. You can find in the Central Zionist Archives in Jerusalem today, right outside of Binyanei HaUmah, or Binyanei HaUmah, in the entrance to Jerusalem. And you'll see here the transcripts of a debate and discussion that happens between Ben-Gurion and others. And Ben-Gurion starts off this conversation and says, listen, you know, Rav Herzog in his Na'um had claimed, right, I have four lines down here, had claimed, like, where are the Islamic leaders? I want to know, Eifo Chochmei Dat Yehudim. I want the rabbis to speak out against this, because now the Jews are using the same methods. Right? What's going on? They need to tell us. Are we allowed to take revenge by killing Dam Naki, right? By shedding Dam Naki, or is it not? Does the Tzav Yehudi lo tirtzach, do not murder, does that apply to us as well, right? Just let me know, like, guys, you know, what's Ben-Gurion basically saying, right? What are they doing here? And what does Judaism have to say about this? And he's very concerned, first of all, it's leading to anarchy, right? This sense of, like, they're just random, like, gangs, he calls them, that they're going to kill, right? And then he wants to say, but beyond that phenomenon, he says, this is hurting us with the British. This is hurting our reputation. Where are the Jewish leaders? And so standing up in response to Ben-Gurion is Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fishman, later known as Rabbi Maimel, who is a member of the Jewish agency executive. And Rabbi Fishman goes and says, listen, I agree with you, Ben-Gurion. It is dangerous to have dissident groups. It's dangerous for us not to be unified in this circumstance. But I want to ask you, are we right in the approach that we're taking? Meaning it's wrong to have dissident groups. Excuse me. But I want to know, are we right actually by the fact that we're not responding? After all, aren't we just raising a generation of cowards? And it's lo yitachen lafkir dam tzirim shelanu, right? How are we leaving, right? Just letting people just take our children. And he adds the following, it's a pretty wild line at the arrow here. Ilmale hayat seir, haya gam hu yotzeh lenkom edam hayudim hanishpach. He says, if I had been younger, I too would take revenge for the spilled Jewish blood. And then he goes on to say, and by the way, you know, you're screaming, telling me, what about lo tirtzach? Well, I can just tell you that according to the Rambam, we'll see where this is coming from later on, I think that the Rambam would say that all of that nation are guilty. So this is Ben-Gurion asking for the Jewish leaders to speak out, and the biggest Talmud Chacham in the room says, I'm not so sure, right, that they're wrong, meaning they shouldn't do it separately, but maybe this is really justified. And Ben-Gurion blows up, but he blows up in a very interesting way. And he says, listen, you're going to rely on the Rambam? How can you rely on the Rambam? The Rambam could have never said what you said for Fishman, because he didn't live in our period. He didn't see the Balfour Declaration or the British Mandate or the situation of the Jews in the diaspora. He didn't undersee the fulfillment of Zionism in our days. You don't know what the Rambam would have said. It's a very interesting claim, because what he's saying back to Rav Maimon is the sources you're going to quote from history aren't that relevant, because those people didn't know what's going on in 1937. And Rav Maimon responds back to him and says, listen, that's fine. I get what you're trying to say, but I just want to tell you that you keep on telling me lo tirtzach, lo tirtzach, and I'm going to tell you that the Jewish Masorah has different opinions on this, because we have other values besides lo tirtzach. And this keeps on going for the next couple of years as well. And he says, you know, in 1939, this is still going on. And so Rav Maimon says in a Jewish executive meeting once again, he says, you tell me lo tirtzach, I'll quote you the pasuk of lo techayeh ko neshama. The pasuk in Devarim that talks about we shouldn't kill out all of the seven Canaanite nations. Lo techayeh ko neshama. So he says, I'm not saying that's applicable today, right? As we see right below him in the Rambam, he knows that we know that the remnants of the Canaanite nations and Amalek, for that matter, have been destroyed. These mitzvah aren't relevant. But what he's trying to say is that if you're asking me about Jewish ethos, the fact that Lo Tirtzach is one of the Ten Commandments doesn't make it any more valuable than other commandments in the Torah, which tell us at times, Lo Techayeh Kol Neshama. Now, what is going on in these Jewish agency executive meetings? So I think part of the question here is there something that the Jewish tradition has to teach us about this dilemma? Which, as you saw, Ben-Gurion is doubtful about, even though, of course, if the rabbis take the position that he wants, he'll be happy to use it, as he makes very clear. Right? He started the Jewish agency meeting and says, where are the rabbinic leaders? And the rabbinic leader stands up, but says something he doesn't want to say. So then he says, I wasn't interested in their rabbinic opinion anyway. Okay? But leaving the cynicism aside, at the heart of the matter, Ben-Gurion is asking is, does the Jewish tradition really have anything to say? And by the way, as I show in my book, he says this again in the 50s as well. There's a whole debate. We'll see this next week also. It'll come up as well. This is going to be a theme of Ben-Gurion throughout the years. So Ben-Gurion is probably challenging that, and Rav Maimon is saying back to him, A, the Jewish tradition has something to say about this, but is it so clear what it has to say? What do we have to say on this issue? What are the values going to be on this? So it's a fascinating debate. And what I want to try now to show you is some of the sources. I'm not going to show you all the back and forth, but I want to show you some of the sources and the statements that each side took. And Rav Maimon is the most outspoken of the supporters of the Etzel and the supporters of those who were using these tactics in response, as reprisal tactics. It could be Rav Meir Bar Ilan was a little bit ambiguous about his own position about it, but certainly Rav Maimon, by his own admission, is the most outspoken supporter of this, and he's also the most, and he's clearly in the minority by his own admission. As we're going to see, the vast majority of the rabbis of the era are very much against this, but I want to understand the arguments back and forth. So as we saw, Rav Maimon, Rav Fishman, right, and quoted the Rambam. The Rambam he's referring to is a statement that the Rambam writes in Hilchot Melachim as an explanation about the obligation of the seven Noahide laws, that all non-Jews have to establish seven laws, seven types of law in their jurisdictions, one of which is having a judicial system. And inter alia, he throws in a line here, much disputed, in which the Rambam says the reason why the citizens of Shechem were worthy of being killed, even though it was just their king who had kidnapped, right, Dina. But he says, but how come then Shimon and Levi go and kill all of them? So he says that they were chayav mita because of they didn't fulfill this idea of implementing dinim, of setting up a judicial system. Vehem ra'u v'yadu v'lo danuhu. They knew the people. They saw what their king had done, and they did nothing. They didn't judge him. This is what the philosophers call responsible bystanders. And so what the Rambam is saying is that as a responsible bystander, they didn't do anything. They have a system. They are chayav mita. And Rav Maimon wants to quote this story from Genesis and say, this proves to us that it's legitimate to attack anyone in the Arab population living in mandatory Palestine because they are doing nothing to stop what their brethren are doing to us. Is this a compelling claim? And I would argue back to you that it's not particularly compelling because if you look in the later portions of Bereishit, it's true in Perek Lamed Dalet, right, in the story of when it comes up. So Yaakov, their father, is very concerned that this is going to endanger him, right? And it's going to lead to some political problems for him. But if you look later in the Torah, later in Sefer Bereishit, when Yaakov speaks to his sons, he's highly critical of them. Klei Hamas, right? That's not referring to the terrorist group, of course, right? But Klei Hamas, Mechorotahem, right? He's very critical of them. And as the Ramban explains, what the last word in the Torah is, the last message that Yaakov gives is what they did was wrong. Meaning, contra the Rambam, the Ramban says this is wrong. So says Rav Hirsch, for example. It's very interesting, actually. The Ora Chaim has an interesting explanation where he says that the sons of Yaakov just wanted to kill the kings. But once they came for the kings, what ended up happening was all the members of their community came to defend them. And once they came to defend them, they were killed as well. But whatever it might be, citing Shechem as a paradigm, it's not so clear that's a good paradigm because if you look later in the Torah, they are criticized for their actions. So we have to look for some other potential sources to support. And here Rav Maimon quotes a Gemara in Sanhedrin, which the Gemara tells us that, okay, this is talking about the context of a plague, right? Think back to Corona. And the Torah tells us, Gemara tells us, Kevan shenitan reshut l'mashchi, enu mavchin ben tzadikim l'rashim, rishayim. Once permission is granted to destroy, to kill, it does not distinguish between the righteous and the wicked. Okay, now, what's his point? His point, which is true, is that, and during a natural plague, of course, that it can spread to anyone. And once the Malach HaMavet has charge, right, it can do a lot of things. But it's not really a great proof because what is this describing? What happens during a plague, it doesn't mean that we should be the Malach HaMavet and not distinguish between the Tzadikim and Rishayim. And in fact, if you look in the Gemara goes on to lament, right? You have a sayis of Rabbi Yosef is crying over the fact that righteous people die in this time of calamity. So to say that because of a time of Rishut L'Mashchit, we don't distinguish, it's hard to say that that should allow for indiscriminate killing. We'll come back to some other arguments that Rav Maimon is going to make. What I'm just trying to point out is that the initial arguments that we've seen are certainly not bona fide arguments. Now let's go to see some of the people that supported the principle, the policy of Havlagah. And by the way, this is where the notion of Tarat HaNeshek, purity of arms, emerges. It's precisely in 1937 when this phrase starts to emerge in circles of the Jewish Agency and the Haganah and talk about this idea that we're going to use our weapons, but meaning we're not pacifists. We're going to fight, but only for the aim of self-defense and not against those who shouldn't be targeted. And one of the biggest rabbinic supporters of this is Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel. Rav Amiel is the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He beats out in the elections 3 years earlier, Rav Soloveitchik. Right? That was the one time Rav Soloveitchik came to, Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Amiel beats out Rav Soloveitchik in the vote. You know, that's pretty good. Yeah, you know, that's not bad. In any case, and he's a fascinating figure as the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And Rav Amiel is very, very strident against this, and I want to see some of his arguments. He basically, in a essay, he writes in the Hatzofet newspaper of July 21st, 1938. So, and then he repeats this again, it gets published somewhere else as well, and he says the following. He says, listen, we're calling this policy Havlaga, self-restraint. Why should it be called that? You know what we should call this policy? This should be the Lo Tirzach policy. Meaning, it's not just an instrumental, pragmatic restraint. It's fundamentally, we believe, as he writes, Lo Tirzach b'lo shum tenaim, u'b'li shum yoseh min haklal, right? No exceptions to the rule. We do not shed innocent blood. Lo Tirzach, why? Ki shofech dam adam, ba'adam damoy shofech, ki b'tzalam lukim asad adam. Human beings are created in the image of God. That is the basis for the prohibition of illicit bloodshed. We do not kill. And he goes on to quote Yechezkel. Ish v'cheto yumat. We believe that people should die for their own sins, but not for the sins of their fathers or their sons or their fellow countrymen. What is this idea, right? That you're going to go and wipe out people. Chas v'shalom. If there were 100 people in the group and only one of them was innocent, we know which one, it would be usher to kill any of those 100 people because of the suffet. And he's very, very critical. He says the tguva people, right, the people that are arguing for this response, are adopting the nationalism of Bismarck and Hitler. They believe that the ends justify the means, but we don't believe in that. And while, yes, we want to have a Rov Yehudi Beretz Yisrael, our goal isn't just political. It's acharit hayamim letaker olam b'malchut shaddai. Okay? So I don't know if I would call him a tikkun olam Jew, right? Because that has different connotations today, right? But what Rav Amiel is trying to say is we have a vision. And that vision does not involve indiscriminate killing, even in the times of bloodshed. Okay, now I ask you, is that so clear? Because while it is true that you could argue that we don't allow for the targeting of non-combatants, by the way, I'm purposely using the term non-combatants as opposed to civilians or innocents, because, you know, given the nature of asymmetric warfare, the nature of terrorist groups and informal groups, it's not always clear where the civilian and, you know, non-civilian, right, divide happens. I don't know who's innocent, who's guilty, who's involved. I care about combatants versus non-combatants. And one of the things that the Maharal Miprag points out is that it might be true that we don't hold everyone guilty, right? We don't hold Shechem, for example, guilty, because what are they going to do? They could put their leaders, right, on trial. Like, that's unrealistic. But the Rambam said it makes no sense. But he points out that warfare is not two individuals fighting, but rather it's two collectives, shnei umot. Ulefika chutar lem lechom kedin umah sheba lechom ulma acheret. Shetir Torah. And the Torah allows warfare, which inevitably is going to be a collective matter. And so what the Maharal is telling us is that in warfare, the innocent do die, or the non-combatants do die along with them. Now, some like to claim that the Maharal believe that this means you can indiscriminately kill anyone from that area. Oh, we'll see why. Liberally, I'm sure that's not true. But if you see here, Rav Asher Weiss, great posek of Yerushalayim, and Rav Yaakov Ariel, great posek, chief rabbi of Ramat Gan, both say that what the Maharal is trying to argue is not that you can purposely target non-combatants, but rather that we have to accept the fact that non-combatants are going to be killed amongst the other territory. Well, in other words, what he's trying to point out is that Rav Amiel is trying to give this very forceful, every individual responsibility, and the reality of warfare is that collectives suffer or get rewarded for what else happens in their collective group. And so, it's not so simple to say, right, that we would just say that, okay, we can only kill those who are sinning against us because the nature of warfare is a collective nature. Now, there's a couple other sources again invoked here. I want to see some other voices as well. You have here Rav Uziel, chief rabbi then by 39, who first of all says we have the notion in the Torah, it's very important that we cannot redeem the land. We will not be allowed to have the land unless we do it, right, with Torah values. But this notion of Shvichut Damim, it goes against Egla Rufa, right? It goes against a lot of things. But then he quotes, most interestingly, the Medrash about the fear of Yaakov, of Jacob, when he's about to fight Esav. And the Torah tells us, Vayirah Yaakov Me'od, he's greatly fearful. The Medrash says he was both fearful, Shema Yehareg, that he is killed, and he was worried also, Im Yaarog Et Acharim. He was nervous about killing others. So all the Mefarshim asked, what are you talking about? What are you nervous about? They're coming to kill you. Right? So why would he be fearful of that? And the different Mefarshim give different explanations, but the Maharal gives a very interesting explanation. The Maharal says that it could be that the 400 people, the people that came with Esav, were there for the scene, but they didn't actually want to fight and weren't going to fight against him. And so the Maharal is, it says that Yaakov was worried that he would illicitly kill others who were a part of Esav's collective, but had no intent to kill him. This is two prakim before the Maharal says what he says earlier, which is one of the many reasons why I'm confident that the Maharal never was telling us that you're allowed to simply kill indiscriminately. And the model of Yaakov is one in which we see that we have concerns. We need to be concerned about killing those who do not want to kill us. Now, I want to mention a couple other factors and then see what we get from this debate. So, as I mentioned, Rav Uziel quotes the story of Yaakov, but Rav Herzog, we talked about a little bit earlier as well, also brings up another factor. And Rav Herzog is certainly the most cosmopolitan of the rabbis, the leading rabbis of the time. Right? He's got a PhD. He'd been the chief rabbi of Ireland. Right? He had learned at Sorbonne for a while. And Rav Herzog is very mindful. I'm not saying others aren't, but he's very mindful of the factor of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. And he says, people say to me, what have we accomplished by self-restraint? And he says, Hisagnu hiseg gadol, kiddush Hashem leinei kol hagoyim. We mekadesh shem shamayim, that even in the worst of circumstances, we held to our great moral fortitude. We must keep this going, chalila, for us to go against. Now, I ask you, is kiddush Hashem really a factor here? And the answer, I think, is yes. But the question is, how do you understand Kiddush Hashem? Because you could say there's a fact, of course, of behaving ethically. But if you look in the Torah, there's also another way of understanding Kiddush Hashem, which comes up, which Moshe says to Hashem when he's about to wipe them out, the sin, Chet Egel, and says, Lama Yomru Mitzrayim, Lemor Ra'aretz What will the Egyptians say? And again, Yeshua, when God's angry. If you don't let us win this battle, Yeshua says, your name will be, your reputation will be sullied. And in Tehillim we say, Lama yomru hagoyim ayena Elohim. The goyim will say, where is their God? And most powerfully in Yechezkel Lamed Vav, where we're taught, the prophet says, the reason why Jews will get redemption is there's no greater chilul Hashem than Jewish exile and Jewish powerlessness. And therefore God is going to bring them back. Lo lemanchem, ki im l'shem kodshi, asher chilaltem bagoyim asher bratem sham. What is the poem trying to get at? Chilul Hashem, and this is something that was remarked back and was later really promoted by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, but is already present at this time, which basically says, it's a chilul Hashem for Jews to be killed with no response. Meaning, people are going to say, like, this is God's nation, that they get destroyed and killed so easily? That's a chilul Hashem. And so, the factor of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem is really a double-edged sword. I want to mention one other factor right now, and that's the time period that we're in. Because remember, this is not 1920s. This is not the 1950s. We'll discuss that next week. This is the late 1930s. And of course, no one knows that the Holocaust is on its way, but they know that the clouds of war are hanging over Europe. They know that the situation of the Jewish people is very, very bad in Europe. Jabotinsky and others are going and screaming, and Poland, other places, and saying, you gotta get out of here. And Jews in Eretz Yisrael are saying, we got to the British and to others, we gotta open up the gates. Because things are looking bad with Hitler. And it's very fascinating. Rav Amiel, in the heart of summer 1938, when things were really, really heated in this battle, goes and says, listen, this is terrible. This whole phenomenon of calling it, of this response, lo tirzach, not lo, not havdagas, who said, and says as follows. I want you to know, im afila If you would tell me that killing random Arabs, meaning fighting terror with terror, if you would bring the Gula Shlema, chova aleinu lidchot at the Gula hazo b'shtei yadayim, I'd say to you, we don't want that Gula. V'lo li'gael b'dam, and we shouldn't be redeemed with this type of behavior. That's a very strong statement. And that's being a statement that's being said in 1938. And you ask yourself, what Rav Amiel is actually invoking something. He's not intentionally invoking something, but he's invoking an idea which comes up in a Latin phrase, which says, even if the heavens fall, right, I'm not going to go against my moral imperative. And you ask yourself, is that really right? And it's interesting, by the way, Jabotinsky, who in 37 wasn't so interested in these reprisal attacks, but by 38 and 39 is more or less coming out in support of it. Remember, Jabotinsky's exiled of Palestine in 1930, by 1931 by the British. So he's in Europe, but so he's not there on the ground, but more or less he's supporting it sort of subtly, from afar. And in a speech which he gives on Shabbat, July 12th, 1938, Jabotinsky gets up in Warsaw and gives a very interesting speech where he says as follows. I want you to know that in the time of a famine, are you allowed to steal? No. And if you're poor and you steal from a rich person, is that against the law? Yes. But if it's a famine and you are starving, even though the law says one thing, the shofet will come and say, Einu Hashem, not guilty. What is Jabotinsky trying to argue? He's trying to say, look at the reality right now. This is a time of emergency. And indeed, by the way, Rav Maimon has a really fascinating debate again, once again, 1939, where Rav Maimon was being told by Osishkin and says, Jewish morals and history tell us that we should be against terror. And Rav Maimon says, well, maybe our morals tell us this, but Jewish history tells us something different. And what that Jewish history tells us is, At the end of the day, the goyim, when they're trying to kill us, all want to kill us. And for once and finally, the Jews need to fight back. In other words, whatever the letter of the law might be telling us, if you want to live and you want to survive, just as you might need to steal in a time of a famine, so too you need to fight. And at some point, you gotta shoot. And if you don't know who to shoot at, you gotta shoot someone. That's what reprisals do. Is that type of argument acceptable in Jewish law? Which, of course, is a type of argument which says that the ends of this case would justify the means. So it is very interesting. One second, let me try to. There we go. If you look in, there's a really interesting medrash. And the Medrash tells us that there's a discussion about two great loves. One is the love of the Torah and one is the love of the Jewish people. And the question is, which of these loves are greater than the other? And at one point I thought the Torah, meaning the law, took precedent. But then he goes and says, Avalani Yisrael Kodmo. I believe that the Jewish people take precedent over the law. What in the world does that mean? So it's interesting, in the midst of World War I, if Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook gets stuck in Europe during World War I, he traveled Erev Tisha B'Av to Switzerland, to that's Switzerland, to Germany. To be in a rabbinic conference that was supposed to start right after Tisha B'Av. But Tisha B'Av 1914 is when World War I breaks out. Rav Kook gets stuck in Europe during World War I. He makes it initially to Switzerland. And when he's in Switzerland, he has an interesting correspondence about some of these types of issues. And inter alia, he makes the following claim. He says, listen, when there are times if we'd have to save the Jewish people, lemigder milta, I would say you could do anything, including kill or kill yourself or be killed in order to save all of Klal Yisrael. And he quotes this medrash from Tanna b'Eliyahu, which says that Yisrael kodem le'Torah. That's a really fascinating idea. But keep in mind, friends, if you think that saving the Jewish people overrides, that can go a lot of different ways. So you could invoke it in the times of Jabotinsky and say this is a supreme emergency. In the times of supreme emergency, lemigdar milta, we can go and do what it takes in order to save the Jewish people, including killing random Arabs. Of course, you could say, right, in a different way. You could say that maybe they should allow us to trade land for peace. Because even if you think it's a prohibition of seizing territory, right, nonetheless, you could say, well, even as a prohibition of seizing territory, of getting rid of territory, but for the sake of saving the Jewish people, it should be allowed. And indeed, by the way, some of the rabbinic proponents for land for peace, both in 1937 and later in the 90s, the Oslo Accords, quoted this Gemara to say, even if you think it's a technical prohibition, we have to prioritize saving the Jewish people. All I'm trying to point out here is that this notion of supreme emergency is a tricky one. But in any case, because of that, by the way, Ben Gurion and Chertok were both very adamant to say that this doesn't work. Whether it, leaving aside the morality of it, Ben Gurion says, look what happens every time we kill random Arabs. You fight terror with terror. What ends up happening? They get more worked up and the British hate us. It doesn't work. To which Rav Maimon says, you know why it's not working? Because you're not joining us. But if all of us would fight and fight terror with terror, we would get rid of the Arab revolt and it would force the British to open the gates of Palestine to the Jews of Europe. How does this debate get resolved? The answer is, it doesn't, because once World War II breaks out, the Jews, both the Etzel and the Haganah, decide they're no longer going to fight the British, they're no longer fight. They need to create stability in Palestine because we now need to focus on fighting the Nazis. Who was right? Quick show of hands for those of you who I can see the screen. Which of you think it would be justified what the Etzel did? Killed about 250 Arabs, random Arabs. Who here thinks that this was immoral or wrong? Okay, a few more than around this side, right? I am not going to answer that question. Right? I have my feelings of it. I have a lot of doubts about the effectiveness of it. I actually think Ben Gurion's right, that in general, if you look, by the way, when you look at World War II, people say we had morale bombing. But if you look at the British leaders of the army years later, they said morale bombing did nothing against the Germans. The same way it did nothing against the British, right? When they bombed Coventry and they bombed London and whatnot. Just got them all worked up, the British said, we're going to fight them on their beaches, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not clear to me that this is an effective strategy at all. Right? In some ways, that sort of changes the whole conversation. But what's more interesting to me is the following. If you look at this debate, did anyone here support, quote, sources that weren't legitimate halachic sources? Right? I mean, if you look at this, look at all the sources that we saw, right? These notions of Chilul Hashem, these notions that Rav Amiel brings up of Tzelem Elokim and you shall not murder and Ish. Individual responsibility and tikkun olam and our vision of the end of days. But there's also a notion that there is warfare. Warfare is sometimes allowed. Warfare is a collective. We have to not create cowards. We have to support our own people. Kiddush Hashem, Chilul Hashem. All of these are real values. And I would argue to you that what happens between 36 to 39 in this first great debate about Jewish military ethics is that the rabbis, not just the rabbis as we saw, right? Jews are invoking and bring about the first enunciation of critical principles of Jewish military ethics. And in my book, I try to develop here the nine principles of Jewish military ethics, which include that when fighting, we have the dignity of mankind, we have inherent wrong of illicit bloodshed, we have individual responsibility, the vision of world peace. But we also understand that warfare is necessary to pursue justice. The warfare is collective. That we're going to favor our own collective. They're going to have national partiality. That we need that bravery and courage when we're fighting a just war. And we need to care about our national honor. Kiddush Hashem, which is a double-edged sword. And I would argue to you that what emerges from this debate is the great principles, and part of the lesson that we always have to ask ourselves is, how do we balance these values? Or how do we determine which of these values are applicable or should dominate or should trump others in the given scenario? This is what I happen to think this is true about Jewish ethics in general, medical ethics, other areas as well. But I certainly think this is the case with military ethics when we don't have a clear precedent of psak halacha to work with. But instead, what we do have, which is very valuable, is a set of principles that can guide us in thinking about some of these dilemmas. And so my argument is to say that we developed during this time period a critical set of tools. And what I believe makes something a Jewish perspective is when I know that people are taking into account these different principles in their calculations. Of course, people are going to disagree about how to prioritize and how to balance these values, which one's applicable, but that's going to happen always. So that's why we have a lot of machloket in Judaism. But the idea of saying that you should take into account these values in general is very, very critical in my mind, because that's what Judaism espouses when it comes to ethical issues. It's a multi-value framework. And what fundamentalists get wrong in both directions is they only speak about one value or not the other. So if you just care about we should win, that's it. then all that you're going to end up happening is taking one value in mind and not keeping to value other values. But the same way when sometimes these human rights groups or whatnot say no murder, no killing of anyone who's not fighting can be justified. They're only taking into account one type of view, one value, without taking into account other values as well. And so my argument to you is that the Jewish multi-value framework is very, very valuable because it helps us set on the table what are the values that we should take into consideration. And I'll take questions now, but I want to share with you one final perspective. And this is the perspective of Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin, of course, he becomes the first chief rabbi of the IDF, and then chief rabbi of Israel. And Rav Gorin is around already in the 40s. And Rav Gorin, reflecting on what's going on after World War II, before the War of Independence, talks about the Stern game, Lechi, and says, listen, I had some issues with that. Lo iti tamim deim kol ha'pu'olot gelo shehem asu. I wasn't so happy with all of their activities. Hayiti neged retzach shel ravim rak mishum shehem ravim. I was against the murder of Arabs just because they're Arabs. Dati lo haya notcha b'kach. I wasn't happy with this. Hinagati l'retzach shel anashim shelo chatu v'lo shelo pashu. I was against the killing of people who had not sinned. Hayu lanu harbei mor vikuchim avrak ideologi v'en many ideological debates. B'chol zot ani rav. I am a rabbi. V'yesh lanu mot musar shelanu. We have our standards of ethics. Obusar shel Torah, right? The ethics of the Torah, which say, Kol Adam Nivra B'Tzelem Elokim, or created the image of God. L'chein, anachli tzuchim l'chus, u'lechabed chayim shel kol Adam. We have to have mercy and respect the lives of all people, b'tanai, on condition, shalom ha'ves sakana b'vreinu v'lo chimbanu. It doesn't represent a danger to us and doesn't fight against us. I felt that the attack that was legitimate was against the British, but not against the random Arab who is not trying to harm us or fighting against us. And so what Rav Gorin is saying is very powerful because he's saying, listen, I respect it. I understood why the Lechi wanted to fight and why they were upset and what they wanted to accomplish. But we needed to accomplish it, and we could accomplish it in a different way that would take into account these principles, including, as he notes, the notion that all humans were created in the image of God. I think it's a very, very, very powerful message. And I think that this was right ultimately in the 30s as well. And it's certainly right in Bizman Azeh, right? Where occasionally you hear people where they say, oh, Israel should fight terror with terror and just, you know, drop indiscriminately bombs, whatnot. I think it's just crazy, especially when you have a army that knows how to fight and can fight discriminately by targeting combatants. But this is, like I said, I think this first great moment of debate when things get developed in this time period. Okay, let me take a look at the chat. And Menachem Begin turned away from the Stern gang. Yeah, Menachem Begin, that's correct. When Menachem Begin takes over the Etzel in the 40s, Menachem Begin is against attacking non-combatants. He's very interested in attacking combatants or attacking symbols, very British symbols of power, immigration offices, bridges, and whatnot. Judy asks, what about the idea that if someone comes to you, kill you, you should strike first? Yeah, that's an important principle for sure. But remember, what's going on in the times here of the 30s? It's not that they're coming and killing those who are threatening them. We're killing random Arabs because we don't know who the people are who are actually fighting against us. And so Bagana is saying you can't just go and kill a random person. And the Etzel is saying if you don't fight someone, you got to fight someone. You got to shoot someone. Whoever that, preferably it would be the people that are actually fighting against us. But if we can't figure out who those people are, then we need to go and fight and kill anyone. Wow, sir. Okay. I will open up for a couple more questions. Let me just see if there's... Can I combat on how these values apply in guerrilla warfare, as in Gaza, where you cannot distinguish between combatants and non-combatants? Len, that's an excellent question, and we are going to discuss that next week and the following week. All right, you're absolutely right. That is a question. Dr. Irene Lancaster, I'm going to open up.
Thank you very much. Very a lovely talk. I just wanted to say something, though. You probably know that Rav Kook, when he was chief rabbi, till he died in 35, actually hid weapons for the Irgun and the Lehi, and that you mentioned David Raziel, and the daughter of the chief rabbi of Haifa, Sha'ayashuv Cohen, who was used as a go-between for Rav Goren. It's all in his autobiography, which I translated. His daughter is called Eliraz as an anagram, who is a very quiet lady who lives in Efrat, aged about 70, who is my friend. Because the thing is, I know you're only doing the early period of the 20th century, but I don't think any of them could have anticipated what's going on with Hamas. And we are all very upset about all the soldiers that are risking their lives, apparently with one hand tied behind their backs because of policy. I know you're not up to 2024, and I don't know where you live, whether it's in Israel or America, but the fact is our blood is just as red as anyone else's. And I was surprised to read about the Nazir and Rav Kook not supporting Lehi, as you read out from Rav Goren, but certainly helping, because the Havlagah against the British, which I am, didn't help in the end.
Well,
It didn't help.
so let me thank you for the comment. Just to clarify, Rav Kook dies before this debate, meaning Rav Kook Sr. dies before this debate. Rav Kook did help, you're correct, he was supportive of the Haganah and his self-defense methods after 29 and whatnot, right? This is part of the controversy he has with the ultra-Orthodox. Rav Kook was certainly in favor of Jewish defense. The question is, what tactics can be allowed towards Jewish defense? I live in Israel. I live in Modi'in, to answer another question. And as I try to argue in the book, I think I put it in the chat, the link to it. But I am in favor. I do believe that when push comes to shove, we do need to prioritize our soldiers and make sure that we protect them, as opposed to running risks of collateral damage. This is a big debate amongst just war theorists, and I do feel that way. But having said that, that doesn't mean we should just be dropping bombs indiscriminately. I don't think that the way Israel's fighting right now is one hand behind our back. And the current case right now, I don't think that's it. I mean, the bigger issue we have is that we have to worry about killing captives, which is a massive issue, which is a mass matter of debate. But okay, but I mean, the issues you're bringing up are going to come up more again in the next couple of weeks as well. So don't worry. We're just getting warmed up here. Just getting warmed up. But I appreciate it. Okay. Did I miss? Susanna, were you trying to? Or is there someone else who's?
They're just pointing to Ben Melech having their hand up.
Oh, okay. I for some reason I don't see, and I apologize here. For some reason I do not see. It seems I've lost him. But I see there's a question in the chat from him where, which neighboring states to Israel have such discussions? Oh, yeah. So you're right. I mean, this is a big issue. If no one else cares about ethics, do we have to care about this as well? And please God, that'll precisely be the discussion next week, because one of the issues that are going to come up in the 50s is, does Israel have to hold itself to higher standards than our neighboring countries? Because you could say, well, listen, we just have to fight based on the ways in which other people fight. If they're willing to fight this way, we'll fight this way. If they're willing to fight that way, we'll fight that way. If they won't have restraints, we shouldn't have restraints. And that's precisely part of the conversation, which we'll get into, please God, next week. Okay. I look forward to seeing you all then. In the meantime, you're welcome. I will put in the chat also, there's a discount code for the book on the Koran website, Ethics 15. The book again is called is Ethics of Our Fighters. Not to be fighters, not to be confused with Ethics of Our Fathers. I know my previous book was called A Guide to the Complex, play on, of course, a guide, Maimonides. And someone once went to a Koran book sale and said, I'm looking for Maimonides, Guide to the Complex. And they said, we don't produce that book, but we do have Rabbi Brody's book, A Guide to the Complex. He looks at it and goes, okay, I'll take this anyway. That's fine. So, you know, I'm sort of hoping for that type of thing. But if you're looking for sales of Ethics of Our Fathers, you're looking in the wrong place. All right. Good to see everyone. And we'll be speaking next week. Take care.